Welcome to the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. I'm your host, James Renford Powell, author of The Laws of Material Wealth and the Renford Books. And if you have been following us at all, you know we had 54 shows dedicated to the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. This is the most comprehensive personal development program available anywhere that I know of. And it includes the book, the workbook, 4 DVDs, a CD, a second workbook that's called the support material, which is 54 lessons, and then we had 54 shows, one-hour shows, on this show as part of the Radio by Renford Network. And we are now talking to people who are starting businesses, developing nonprofits, have different programs. We're trying to talk as much as possible to people in the Memphis area because this is where we're based, but in fact, we have had people on from as far away as New Zealand. So it is truly an international show. It also goes to Dream Vision 7 Radio out of Boston and goes to a listener base in 138 countries. Our guest tonight, Patricia Lee, due to scheduling conflicts, will not be able to be with us tonight, but will be with us soon in a future date. Patricia is the host of a terrestrial radio program here in Memphis, as is my guest this evening. She's also the author of My True Sense, which is a book publishing at I Am Press. And we're hopeful that she can be with us again very soon. However, tonight we have with us Omar Baruti. And Omar also has a radio show on the local station here. In fact, comes on right after Patricia's. And we'll be back in a few moments, and I'll tell you more about Omar Baruti and his organization and his work. And away we'll go. Remember that if you have people who would like to listen to the show but maybe don't have a computer or not online, all they have to do is call 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142, and they can listen to the show. Or go to blogtalkradio.com/Renford. That's Blog Talk, BLOGTALK, blogtalkradio.com/Renford. And you can listen to the show there or on the telephone at 347-838-9142. Anyone would like to ask a question of my guest tonight, Omar Baruti, all you have to do is press the 1 button on your touchtone dial, and that will flag me to bring you in for your question. Just keep that in mind. And we'll get on now with the Renford Revelation. The Renford Revelations are available. All of the previous ones are available to be read or downloaded by going to www.iam-cor.org. That's iam-cor.org. And when you get that to that point, just put a /after it and say blog, and that'll take you directly, type in blog, and that'll take you directly to the blogs, and you can listen to them there, or rather you can read them there. You can also make comments and participate. But I have been reading a new one each week on this show from the first few minutes of the show, and then we'll get to our guest, Omar Baruti. The title of this one is Apocalypse, Revelation, Not Catastrophic. What I mean by this is that you got a lot of people running around talking about this being apocalyptic or that being apocalyptic, and they don't even know what apocalyptic means. And when you hear somebody doing that, then you know right away they don't know what they're talking about. All right, apocalypse, the word apocalypse means revelation. It was the apocalypse of John. It was the revelation of John. And this idea of calling things apocalyptic and meaning end of time, it comes from really an improper interpretation of the book of Revelation, and I know very few people who have any idea whatsoever about it, regardless of how much they think they may. This is a book of symbols, and it's always amazed me that somebody would try to come up with a literal meaning from something where within one sentence you can have three or four different symbols. Anyway, these are my thoughts on Revelation. Nowadays, there's always someone talking about an event being apocalyptic. They seem to equate the word apocalyptic with the word catastrophic due to a literal interpretation of the book of Revelation, the last book in the New Testament. The word does not mean catastrophic. Apocalypse simply means a revelation. This book was called the Apocalypse of John. It was the revelation of the mysteries that Jesus spoke of when he told the apostles, "To you I have revealed the mysteries." They rarely seem to fully understand what he meant, and it is obvious that there is little understanding of the book of Revelation. All of the rest of the quotes in this article, or in this blog, come from one individual, a lady named Emily Cady from New York, who lived about 100 years ago, and wrote so powerfully that Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, founders of the Unity Movement, printed many of her articles and a very interesting book called Lessons in Truth. She wrote, and I quote, "What you want is revelation of truth in your own soul, and that will never come through the reading of many books." She goes on, this is another quote of hers, "Understanding is a spiritual birth, a revelation of God within the heart of man." She says, "Unless truth is revealed to you by the Father in heaven, it is of no practical benefit to you or anyone else. This revelation of truth to the consciousness of a person is spiritual understanding." She says, "The very spirit of truth, which has come to abide with you forever in your consciousness, takes deep things of God and reveals them to you. You will no longer run to and fro seeking teachers or healers and rely solely on them for guidance. You know that the living light, the living word within you will guide you into all truth," as it's noted in John 16:13. She says, "What we need to do is seek the revelation of the living Christ within our own being, each for himself, knowing that only this divinity, come forth, can make us powerful and happy." She says, "That which God would say to you and do through you is a great secret that no man on the face of the earth knows or ever will know except yourself, as it is revealed to you by the Spirit that is in you. The secret that he tells me is not revealed to you, nor yours to me. But each man must, after all is said and done, deal directly with the Father through the Son within himself." She says, "We want a revelation of God in us as life to be made to our own personal consciousness as health. We no longer care to have somebody just tell us the words from the outside. We want a revelation of God as love within us so that our whole being will be filled and thrilled with love, a love that will not have to be pumped up by a determined effort because we know that it is right to love and wrong not to love, but a love that will flow with the spontaneity and fullness of an artesian well, because it is full at the bottom that it must flow out." She says, "What we want today is a revelation to our consciousness of God within us as omnipotent power so that we can, by a word or a look, accomplish which I propose and succeed is the thing for which I sent it." Isaiah 55:11. "Each man must come to a time when he no longer seeks external help, when he knows that the inner revelation of my Lord and my God to his consciousness can only come to him through an indwelling power that has been there all the time, waiting and with infinite longing and patience to reveal the Father to the child. She goes on to say, this revelation will never come through the intellect of man to the consciousness, but must ever come through the intuitional to the intellect as a manifestation of spirit to man. Because we have not known how to wait upon spirit within us for the desired revelation, we have run to and fro. And finally, clear, she says, clear revelation, the word made alive as truth to the consciousness, must come to every man who continues to wait upon God. In these quotes, we have a clear picture of what revelation meant to Emily Cady and how we can benefit from this perspective. She is talking about the only real and meaningful revelation to human beings without the symbolic language of the Book of Revelation. The writer or writers of the Book of Revelation were writing to a people very different from us today. It was a different time, and the symbols and metaphors had some significance for a people who understood myth with meaning. A relatively small minority of literalists gained the support of Emperor Constantine because he could use them. In 325, only they were invited to the Council of Nicaea. Constantine had his agenda, and the literalists had theirs. The church Jesus said he would build and that had remained dynamic was encased in the concrete of dogma. In other words, it was hijacked. And various church councils, all the way to the Council of Constantinople, established a different sort of body. How could this happen? It happened because Constantine had all the money and all the power. It has been said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that is not a new revelation. Thank you for listening to the Renford Revelation tonight. And I want to get very quickly to my guest, Omar Baroudi. Omar is part of the Memphis Kwanzaa International and has been so for more than 37 years. You can go check out Kwanzaa by going to www.memphiskwanzaa, that's KwanzaAintl.org, and get further information, and he'll be talking about it. Omar conducts two prison ministries. He's a graduate of Lemoyne Owen. He's taught school in the St. Louis area, East St. Louis. He's been director of Muhammad University, St. Louis, on Grant Avenue there. He's been self-employed in the Memphis area for most of the last 30 years and has been very much a part of the development of Kwanzaa International. Now, Omar has been on the core concepts interviews along with Kaya and Nantan. I really don't want to completely mutilate her name. Could you pronounce it for me, Omar?
Yes, it's Dr. Kaya Nantanbu.
Okay, Nantanbu. They were on the show together. And if you would like to know more about him and about his work, you can go to youtube.com, type in Renford Broadcast Network, R-E-N-F-O-R-D, Broadcast Network, and you'll be able to find that show in the archives there. And that'll give you a little bit more background information on Omar. Omar, it's a pleasure to have you on the show tonight.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I thank Sister Patricia for referring me. Yeah. I really look forward to a nice program.
Yeah, well, I would like to know, there's so much that you're doing that's probably not in the mainstream of our listeners' experience that you can tell us about, and I'm looking forward to you doing that. Could we start with talking a little bit about your ministry with the prison systems?
Yes, sir. I've been a prison minister for over 20 years, and as a member of the Memphis Kwanzaa International, I took the prison ministry about a year ago, and I do the ministry both in the prison in Whiteville, Tennessee. It's called the Hardeman County Correctional Center. and also up in Henning, Tennessee at West Tennessee State Penitentiary. Both of those prisons I go to on a regular basis and administer, you know, to the inmates there, both from a historical and a spiritual point. This is the part of the minister of the...
No, go ahead, sir.
Yes, go ahead. This is the part of the ministry that I really... this is the part of the ministry that I really deeply enjoy, because so many of our young men are locked up because they couldn't find their way.
Hmm. Well, you're very much involved.
We live in a world
interested in the justice system, and that's where you've been directing a lot of attention, isn't it?
Yes, you know, my wife and I have been foster parents. We were foster parents for nearly 10 years, and I was the president of the Phoenix Foster Home Advisory Board. And our home was set up to take children that nobody else wanted. These were children that if somebody didn't take them, they were going to lock them up the same night that they called our home. And so when our home was set up, we were there to give the children structure and meaning. And about half of them, we were able to get back to their biological family or get them adopted. But about half of them, unfortunately, end up in a facility anyway. But again, as we went through that process, we could see what this society has done to the children. And if the children are our future looks very bleak.
Do you? What do you?
Somewhere we get a chance of doing.
When you minister to the prisoners, is this a religious or spiritual based thing, or educational thing, or what do you do?
I do both. A lot of what I teach them is history. Much of what I teach is spiritual, straight from the Quran and from the Bible. I do both because early in life I was a Baptist Sunday school teacher, and I remember what I went through. As a young man, I remember one night I had just studied for my physics exam, and I was about to study for my Sunday school lessons. I could teach Sunday school the next day. It was one Saturday night, and my mother asked me to go to the store and get her some sugar so she could make a cake for Sunday dinner. And this was Saturday night, so I just threw on something and walked out the door, two blocks to the store. But right as I got within a few feet of the store, a police officer pulled up and asked me where I was going. And I said, I'm 19 years old at the time. I was going to the store for my mom. And he said, hold up, nigga. And he stopped the car and told me to come over to the car. So I came over to the car. He got out and put me up against the car. So he put my hands on the top of the car. He patted me down. And then he put handcuffs on me and put me in the back seat of the car. And I was very concerned, because I'm thinking, where are you taking me? What have I done? I just left home. I haven't done anything. So when he put me in the back of the car, he was driving. I kept, insisting that, where are you taking me and what have I done? He looked at me with a little short cigar, and I can never forget his face. He looked at me with that little short cigar in his mouth and said, shut up, nigga. We'll think of something on the way to the station. And as we drove to the police station, and this is in the late 1960s, as we drove to the police station, they booked me in, fingerprinted me, put me in a cell. I called my dad, and my dad, who was, a third grade graduate, because they took him out of the school to go and work in the fields when he was a child, he just simply told me, don't worry, son, I'm going to come get you out. And I'm thinking to myself, he can't come get me out. He rides a bicycle. We don't have a car, and the buses don't run at night. So around 5 o'clock that morning, they came and banged on the bars and said, come on, nigga, you can go. And so I had to walk home because there was no bus service. And so what I did, I walked from the police station back to the church so I could be on time to teach Sunday school. But that experience has stayed with me to this day. And I wonder how many of us have been falsely accused and falsely incarcerated and suffered a serious price for nothing just because of the system that we live in this country. So I always feel like there are others like me that are behind bars. I've been arrested 3 times. Each time it's only because I was black. Hadn't done anything, but just because I'm black. Don't have a criminal record. But because I went through that, I feel like the others that have gone through that, the criminal justice system has not served them well at all. And some have even, you know, been executed for that reason, falsely accused and executed.
And you were living at that time.
Somewhere that system has to change.
You were living at that time in the near Ferguson, or near East St. Louis, or where?
When I was arrested that first time, I was in Binghamton off of Tillman and Johnson, Tillman and Summer. I stayed on a street called Forest Street, here in Memphis, named after Nathan Benson Forrest. But Forest Street is where I stayed, and we were very poor. I mean, we lived in a shotgun house, 11 children in a one-bedroom shotgun house. Very poor, but we didn't know we were poor. Everybody on the street was poor, so that's all we knew, and everybody on the street was, you know, we were family. Right across the street was a school teacher who taught, and she graduated at Rust College, but, you know, they were still poor. Next door was a brother that worked for the sanitation department. Another one down the street worked for the city of Memphis, putting in oil on the street when they were trying to do street repair. But we were all still in the same condition. But again, when I got arrested, that was my first encounter with the police. I had seen them, and I had seen some of the things they had done, and had experienced it through other people's experiences, but I had never experienced it firsthand. In fact, my brother, who's a year and some months older than me, him and a friend of his were dating. And this is in 1966. They were dating, car dating as they called it back then. And they were one street over on a street called Alcorn. The police pulled up behind them and made them get out of the car and searched them. And then they took their two dates and put them in the back of the police car and drove away. And later on, the two girls were called their mothers. They'd been taken out somewhere out in Shelby County in the woods and been raped. And even though they put a police report in, as I had put a police report in for the arrest, and Dr. Price at Lemoyne College actually took me to the police station and we filed that police report. And they told him that, you know, we could arrest him and hold him for 3 days without charging with anything, just based on suspicion. Well, these two girls could have put a report in with badge numbers, and nothing was done about it. But that was in the 60s and the early 70s. But again, that kind of thing is just—it's still here. It's just morphed into a more hidden type of activity.
Now, how do you advise the inmates? Do you actually advise the inmates?
I'm teaching the class right now at the Harnett County facility. It's a business class. I've been self-employed since I was 23 years old. I'm 67. And I teach them how to go into business. But right now, my wife has just started a business with a bakery, and she has her product at Whole Foods, and she's going through a process with Kroger. Everything is in except that, you know, putting it in the computer to do her products in the Kroger stores here in Memphis. But I teach them how to go into business for themselves, because what I want them to understand is that if you have a felony on your record, your chances of getting a job are next to none. And they are men who don't have anything on their record, and they have a hard time getting a job with a clear record. So the best thing you can do is become self-employed. Because when you become self-employed, people don't generally ask about your criminal record. They ask, can you do the job, and can you give them a good price? So I'm encouraging them how to go about setting up a business and how you can make it profitable for yourself. My last 10 years in business, I was an insurance agent, and each year I made over $100,000 a year for the last 10 years. So I'm telling them, you know, there are ways to make it happen. Real estate, it all avenues for it. With real estate, plumbing, you know, electrical wire, all kinds of ways to do it and do it right and become successful at doing it. So I teach a class like that, but I also go up to the scriptures. I do it every other Friday. One day we have spiritual, next Friday we have the business. So I want them to get out with hope that don't worry about looking for a job. You can find one, good, but if you can't find one, then let's take this information, set up a business, and then use the skills I accumulate, I acquire, and make that happen for me, just like it's happened to other people.
Very good idea to work with them on being entrepreneurs. That's, in fact, that's what the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program is about. We're dealing with spiritual principles, which are the success, real success principles, or spiritual principles, and working toward helping folks become prosperous and achieve their objectives. You mentioned you teach history and you're teaching business. Now, is that not what Kwanzaa does, is try to bring to them some history of the black race and of what the situation has been? Maybe better you just tell us what Kwanzaa is all about.
Memphis Kwanzaa is a celebration of our culture, our family, and our history. And what we teach in Memphis Kwanzaa is primarily history, because we don't know our history. Many of us believe that our history started with slavery. We don't know anything beyond slavery, that we were slaves, and we went through this terrible ordeal, the Holocaust coming over here, and when they let us out of slavery, we were not debriefed, we were not compensated. We were just thrown to the wolves, and we're in this condition now because of that. They don't realize that black people have a rich history that goes back not hundreds of thousands of years, but millions of years, and that in the beginning of time, black people was the only people here. If you go anywhere on the earth, anywhere, I don't care what, China, Japan, anywhere you want to go, if you go to the original people in that part of the world, it were black people. And the archaeologists, the anthropologists, have documentation showing that. But we don't know that. If our people knew their history, if our people could go back and get and retain their culture, go back and get it back, then the troubles, the ills that we have in our community would go away overnight. Because the things that we do are not part of our culture. We got to go back and recapture our culture. Even back in my day when I was a child, you didn't disrespect elderly people. In fact, when we left home, we didn't even lock the door. We had a screen door. We didn't have no iron door. And the lock we had on the door was primarily to make sure it stayed shut when the wind blew. It wasn't to keep anybody out. And if somebody came to your house when you were gone, your neighbors looked out for you. You know, I'd have this Louie who was next door to say, well, they're gone. Can I help you with something? If you got in trouble, the whole community, put you on the right track. That's how we lived. It was like a village. It was like a community. Nowadays, you don't even know your neighbors. And you lock your door and put an alarm on it and hope nobody breaks in. We didn't even lock the car. We didn't go shopping. The car wasn't locked. We didn't lock anything. Locks weren't necessary because people lived and respected and trusted one another. Today, that's not the case. And we have programmed our people, not just black children, but all children, to believe that it's normal to lock everything. It's normal to mistrust and distrust people. It's normal to even take advantage of people. We think that's normal. When I look at some of the games these children play, Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, what Christian would buy their child a game called Grand Theft Auto where the object of the game is to steal something, and God teaches you it through the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. And then somewhere in the game there's sex going on in the back of a car seat, and then there's also murder going on. What Christian would buy a game like that for their children? Call of Duty is another, where you're constantly killing people. But most of the games are geared in that kind of direction, and our children are being consumers of these games with the help of the parents, because the parents are buying them. But you've taken the minds of children, and you're poisoning that mind. And then when you put them in a society where there's a consequence for what they did in the game, because in the game there's no consequence of any sort, start a game all over again. But in real life, there's a consequence. The consequence is permanent and it's forever. But the children don't know that. They're not able to discern that in their immature minds. But this country has steered our children in that direction, and that's very toxic for the children and for the society. We got to change that.
Now, Omar, you have a radio show where you are, I assume, attempting to change that, just doing exactly what you're talking about, to educate the public. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And every show that we have, it's called the Love Power Show. It comes on on 1600 AM every Sunday at 12 o'clock with 30 minutes, and sometimes we go over. We're about to change it in April to a one-hour show from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on the same station. But we do that on the Love Power Show. We're looking for solutions. How do we change the reality that we're in right now? One of the things we're going to address is the gangster rap. We have got to get rid of that. That gangster rap that has all the cuss words, where they're denigrating the black woman, they're encouraging people to sell drugs and use drugs, they act like drive-by shootings is the norm. We got to get rid of that. Because if you put that seed in the mind of our children, they end up acting out. They act what they hear and what they see. We got to change that image altogether. Back in the day when they had shows like I Love Lucy, Lucy and Ricky were married, but they slept in twin beds and they had pajamas on. Nowadays, you got people that are on the TV, on regular TV, that are almost naked, sleeping together, and they're doing the children's hour. Cuss words were not even thought of on TV. That was a censorship against using profanity on the TV. Now it's all over the place. It's no big deal. Even in the music, you didn't put profanity in music. Now, it's hard to find a popular musician that doesn't have it. They shouldn't even promote the stuff. But they promote it, and these musicians are coming up with that kind of crap, and they're feeding it to our children. That has to change, but I don't see it changing because the corporation now control the media, and they control the FCC that is supposed to be controlling me, but they control the FCC, so they can do what they want to do. As long as it makes them a dollar, they don't really care about the consequences of it. They don't care about the outcome. So it's really a corporatism that's taking over the country, and the people suffer, but they don't know they suffer. But they do. Our children are really the biggest victim of this whole system. We got to change that.
We got to take charge of it. Yeah, that was what my question was. Do you have some specific proposals that you are promoting to address these problems?
Yeah, one I'm about to launch is a boycott. A friend of mine went to the city council recently to complain about the gangster rap station that is owned by Mr. Flynn, who's on the city council. And Mr. Flynn laughed at him when he came and said, the program is toxic to our children. It shouldn't be on the air. It's a public nuisance. And the city council president told Mr. Flynn to quit laughing. He said, you shouldn't do that. That's disrespectful. And then when the person started talking again, Brother Ike Abioto, then Mr. Flynn laughed again. And the city council chairman had to admonish him again, don't do that. But he was saying that these gangster rap songs are having a negative impact on our children, and we need those things to be taken off the air. Don't do that. And he was talking about other cities like Portland, Oregon, and other places that don't have that kind of media for those children to be exposed to. Now, what I want to do, I don't want to contact Mr. Flynn. I want to contact the churches in Memphis and have the churches to sign a petition saying that if we're going to send a petition to the advertisers, like Sunrise Pontiac. We're going to tell Sunrise Pontiac, if I hear you advertising on that radio station one more time, this church and everybody who signed this petition is not going to buy a car off your dealership for 1 year at least, and maybe forever. We got to go after the advertisers, not after Mr. Swain, because he can't stay on the air without advertising. No radio station can. So I don't want Mr. Swain. I'm not worried about him. If I can go after his advertisers, then we can solve that problem. And we'll send that petition signed by every church I can get to sign it. We're going to send those petition, copies of the petition to that dealership, to that advertiser, let them know we don't appreciate how you're addressing our children. And if you don't do something about it, we will.
Well, that's real community activism there. And the other aspect, the twin thing, is your education program. You're educating prisoners in your prison ministry. What about the general public? I guess that's being done via the radio show.
The radio show, and then we also do a rites of passage program at Memphis Kwanzaa on Saturdays. We do one Saturday for the boys and one Saturday for the girls. What we're trying to do is to is to help them to avoid the pitfalls in the social fabric, because the social fabric is tattered, and help them get a good hold on what it means to be a man, the things that you must do in order to go from boyhood to manhood, because we don't know that. Too many of our homes don't have a man in the house, so they don't know what a real man is supposed to be like. In too many of our homes, the mother's there, but she's really not there, or she's not really an effective parent. So we teach our young girls how to be a woman, a mother, how to be an effective parent when they grow up. So that's part of Mrs. Kwanza's ongoing program. And we
a
do
lot
that,
of people
like every Saturday, once Saturday for the boys.
I think a lot of people think of Kwanzaa only as a kind of a Christmas holiday type of thing, don't they? I mean, could you expand a little bit more on the mission and purposes of Kwanzaa?
Yeah, Kwanzaa is to celebrate the rich culture and history of Black people. For example, if our children, if you know who you are, then you would change your perception of yourself. Right now, we have a very negative perception of ourselves. If you know that you built the pyramid, Black man, you did. And it's still one of the so-called eighth wonders of the world, but it's the only one that's still standing. Something that's a big pyramid, something that's over 40 stories tall, that has over 2 million stones in it, that sits in the middle of a desert, that stays a comfortable 68 degrees night and day with no central heat and no central air. And they are still wondering, how did Black folks build that when they have stones in their pyramids that are anywhere from 10 tons to as much as 80 tons with no heavy-duty equipment dragged across the desert from 600 miles away? How did y'all do that? Well, you look back and see that the monotheism that we practice today was by a man named Akhenaten. When you look at the fact that the first recorded medical doctor in history was Imhotep, not Hippocrates, but Imhotep, who lived thousands of years before Hippocrates was even thought of. And much of what Hippocrates learned was from Imhotep. When you realize that Egypt and that Nile Valley region of the world was a cradle of civilization, there was nobody else here. You were here, Black man. This is your history. Although they paint Moses and these other people from Egypt as being Caucasian, that's untrue. If you lived in Africa, you had no choice but to be a Black person. And if you go back and look at the history and look at the anthropological evidence, then it obviously points to the fact that the first people were Black, and even down until somewhere around 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, they were still that same persuasion. We don't know our history, and as a result, we think very little of ourselves. We don't even know the Holocaust we went through. We don't know the treatment that Black folks suffered during the slave period. Our children know. In fact, one of the textbooks I read in the barter school system in elementary school was saying that Black folks came over here to help the pilgrims build houses. It did not say they came over here in the holds of slave ships. So they have whitewashed our history, and now they're not even teaching it anymore, because they feel like it's too hard for white folks to read that about what their ancestors did. Well, it's too hard for us to forget it. And I want to be just like the Jewish people. I want our children to never forget, so there's no repeat of what happened to us. But our children don't even know it. And therefore, you know, it bothers me when they don't know their history, but they know everybody else's history. Sometimes I wish that what they would do in the city school system and in the country is they would take and swap with us. We have one month called Black History Month, and we learn Black history. Most of it, he never deals with our history before slavery. Most of it deals with the history that we had after slavery. If we could go back and take that one month and give it to America and say, America, we're going to teach American history in February, and the other 11 months we're going to teach Black history, because we need to know our own history, and other people need to know our history too. So let's do it for like maybe two or three generations until we catch up on historical facts. Because once you know us and we know ourselves, then I think our future would be much brighter. I think that's fair.
And so, I mean,
really,
basically, the idea is if they understand their own history, then there's pride in that history, and continuing education. Those are the two prongs of your primary purposes of your program of training, how to make a living, know something about yourself, and take some pride in where you've been and what you've done.
Absolutely. You've got to do that. Got to do it. Otherwise, your reason for existing, you don't have a reason to exist. You're not here just to be to push a broom. You're not here just for menial tasks. You created this, so you should be in charge of some part of it.
Hey,
I mean, this economy in the United States.
Go ahead.
This economy in the United States is built on the back of slaves. I mean, it was the slavery that built this economy. And we talk about welfare, but as I look at the welfare system, the corporations get more welfare than poor people. And they don't call it welfare. They call it tax incentives and all other kinds of fancy names, but it's still welfare. They're not paying their taxes, and they're getting some things for free. But, again, a lot of the problems in this country we can solve. A lot of it we can solve. Just like in the 1930s when they had the Great Depression and the FDR, there was over 25% unemployment among, you know, the Caucasians in this country. And they put everything out there to try to get people back to work so they could, because they know if they could get productivity, they could get the economy rolling. And that's what they did. They made jobs, you know, planted trees, all kinds of jobs were made. Well, in the black community, and most of your major cities, including Memphis, the unemployment rate is sometimes over 30%. And Philadelphia is over 50%. In Chicago, it's over 40%. But no FDR type program is put in place to put these people to work. Something has to happen. And if the government won't make it happen, we got to make it happen. We got over $1 trillion going through the black economy every year, according to the Department of Commerce. That's a lot of money. It's more than some countries have. But we don't spend it among ourselves. Somewhere we need to understand that we got to take that money in our community like the Jews do. The Jewish people are very, very, very wise with the spending of money. And they bounce that money from one Jewish hand to another 10 to 15 times before it leaves the Jewish community. We don't even do it one time. We got to change the way we do. We're good consumers, but we're not producers. We got to change that.
Omar, I believe we have a call for you. Let's see. Hello, caller. You have a question for Omar Baruti? Hello? Do you have a question for Omar? Okay, let me see. That's not going. Let me check that we've got another call right after it. Hello, caller. Do you have a question for Omar Baruti? Hello, caller. It's showing that they have flagged for a question, but neither of them are acknowledging that they have a question, Omar. Can you tell us a little bit about we've got Lemoyne Owen, which is a well-known institution that you graduated from, here in Memphis. What is your experience with Lemoyne Owen?
I attended Lemoyne Owen right after I left high school from 1965 to 1969. Very good school, very conscientious. As a student, I was very poor. So all of my tuition it was paid for through grants and scholarships. When I graduated, I only had a $400 student loan, and I only got that loan because I was an exchange student between Lemoyne and Grinnell College. They sent four Caucasian students to Lemoyne Owen, and they sent four black students to Grinnell for one semester. And because they said you needed some warm winter clothes, they knew I didn't have any. They got me a loan for $400 to buy some warm winter clothes to go to that part of the country up an hour. And so when I graduated, I only had that $400 student loan to deal with. And because I taught school, all that student loan was dissipated because all my teaching was in the inner city school systems in Syracuse, New York, St. Louis, and East St. Louis, and in Kinloch, Missouri. So I didn't actually end up getting anything back. But good school. The teachers were very, very, very attentive to the students, very concerned, and made sure we got what we needed to be able to navigate in the world. I can still talk about them today. Dr. Williams.
You taught in schools in the St. Louis area, but you then became a director of Muhammad University. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was teaching at that time in the East St. Louis, Illinois school system as a teacher in the General Science Middle School. And that year I got Teacher of the Year. And my teaching was, children would always say, you teach all that black stuff, you sound like a Muslim. And I said, what do you mean? I never heard of a Muslim before. I heard that in New York when I taught the first year, and I heard it again in East St. Louis. Because what I wanted my children to relate to is they are scientists that look just like you. So I put on my wall all black scientists. So my children could relate to science through those images on the wall. So they wouldn't think science was foreign to them. And so when I became Teacher of the Year, when they told me I sounded like one of those other folk, I decided, let me go and see what they're talking about. Who are these people that sound like me? Because I don't sound like anybody. So I went to one meeting. And after I went to that meeting, I realized, okay, I've been looking for a ministry to latch on to, because when I was in Memphis, I was actually not put out of the church, but almost put out of the church. I was silenced in the church, in my own Baptist church. I was silenced. And I was silenced because as a young Sunday school teacher, I would go through the neighborhood trying to get parents to let their children come to my Sunday school class. And one parent challenged me, and she said, my child doesn't have anything to wear, but if you can go dress like he's dressed, because I don't have anything to put on him, and if they accept you, then I'll send him next Sunday. So I'm looking at a child that's got, you know, just a plain pair of pants, a little short sleeve shirt, and some tennis shoes on. I'm thinking, there's nothing wrong with that. So I went to Sunday school to teach that same Sunday, and I just took my necktie off. Everything else was the same. I didn't have a one blue suit anyway. I kept it fresh and clean. At least my mom did. So when I took the necktie off, I noticed they made comment. Where's your necktie? Oh, I decided not to wear it today. So the next time they did the same thing, and so you should look better with your necktie on. And I'm thinking, okay, they're noticing that. That's interesting. And they're going to notice a child that's got tennis shoes on, too. So then the third Sunday, they told me, when I didn't wear the necktie, they said, the minister wants to see you in his office downstairs. So I said, okay. So after Sunday school was over, I went down to the minister, the board of trustees, the deacons were sitting there, and they asked me about my necktie. And I said, well, I just decided not to wear it. And they said, well, you have to wear a necktie if you want to teach Sunday school. I said, wait a minute. I said, I thought this was God's house. They said, it is God's house, but you got to wear a necktie in God's house. I said, well, if Jesus came to his house and didn't have a necktie on, had his robe on, you would stop him at the door and tell him he couldn't teach in his own house because he don't have a necktie on? They said, that's beside the point. If you don't wear a necktie, don't expect to teach. So I'm in disbelief. I came with no necktie, and the head of the deacon board pushed me out of the Sunday school class, and he taught the class. Very poorly, he taught the class. And then I noticed that they wouldn't let me do anything. If I raised my hand for a suggestion, since there's no suggestion, we'll move on. I raised my hand to vote on issues in the church, especially the first year when we would have our annual meeting. Look, I couldn't vote yay or nay, and they wouldn't recognize it. I was the Sunday school teacher. I got sat down. I was the head of the choir. They didn't want to recognize that. So anything I was doing in the church became null and void. I started looking for churches to go to after that experience. And then when I went to the mosque in St. Louis, and I could see that you all are making a difference in the lives of people. I couldn't get my church to go even go out in the street and find people. So I saw people I knew were prostitutes. I knew because I would drive past them. But I saw them in the mosque dressed in this white uniform. I'm thinking, well, y'all got that person in here and changed their life like that? Brothers I knew were in the gangs. Y'all got him to drop his gun, put down his drugs, and come in here and put a suit on? Y'all got some powerful stuff in here. Then I realized what they were doing was they were teaching them their history and their culture, and they're teaching them about religion the way it should have been taught. And then I decided, let me become a member. And after I became a member, then they said, can you, since you are a teacher, can you set up Muhammad University? We need a branch of it in St. Louis. And so I looked at Chicago's model, which is our headquarters, and then right after that I came back and I set it up. With the boys coming half a day, the girls coming the other half of the day. And I became the director of Muhammad University after that. And I just never looked back. I just felt like, this is home. I want a place where I can practice my spirituality and save my people at the same time. And I can see the difference. And I still see that difference even today.
Now, is there a Muhammad University in Memphis?
There is a very small one. They don't have much attention. They're trying to expand it right now. Over here on Vance Avenue.
On Grant Avenue?
On Vance Avenue, right across from MIFA.
Vance Avenue.
In East Street. Yes,
Right down near, down close to where the Baptist Hospital used to be. In that area?
Exactly.
Off of Union. Yeah.
In that area. It's on the same street as MIFA. In the same block, but across the street.
Uh huh. Okay, and students can go in and enroll there, and take courses.
And right now, it's elementary only.
Because
in Miami University, we go from kindergarten to 11th grade because in 11th grade you graduate. You ready for college?
Now, are the same kind of classes taught at Kwanzaa?
Similar classes, except they're more comprehensive at the Muhammad University. Muhammad University is just a regular school. Kwanzaa, we do what we do on the weekends. We don't do anything during the week. We do have a First Friday event. Every First Friday, that's a fundraiser for Memphis Kwanzaa. We have a jazz, reggae, a festival every First Friday. Tickets are $15, and it normally opens around 7 and goes to midnight. But that's a fundraiser to help with our ongoing expenses for Memphis Kwanzaa.
Is the program also embraced by the white community? Do they come to these events too?
They do, but not in large numbers. And we even have them calling to trying to find out where they can buy a kanara, the candle holder, the candles, the thing that you use to celebrate Kwanzaa. And really, they don't celebrate in large numbers because it's not commercialized like Christmas and Thanksgiving and Halloween and some of these other days that they can make, you know, the merchants can make money off of. They're not commercialized like that. All these holidays are commercialized, and everybody knows about them. Kwanzaa's not done that way. If they can make some money off of it, of course, everybody would sell it.
Yeah. Now, could you tell us a little bit about Umoja? Because I know there's an event coming up there that Patricia gave me a flyer on the other day about Umoja event. Could you talk about that?
Umoja is a Swahili word that means unity, and Sister Patricia came up with an idea of bringing the different groups together in unity so we could do something about the plight of our children. There's an event coming up at the Awanada Center right there behind the Social Security office on Austin P. this coming Saturday. There's a banquet. Tickets are $25 for adults and $10 for children. There's a program that starts at 5 and goes until 7, but there's a banquet, and that's included in a $25 fee. And most of the proceeds go to help Marcus Garvey Institute, which is a school that's been around a long time in the black community, educating our children. I have two children that actually attended Marcus Garvey. One of them is at the University of Arkansas in Pine Bluff. She is 18 years old, soon to be 19 years old. But she is a her first year in the University of Arkansas at Pambla, but she, because she took some college credits at Lemoyne, but her foundation was at Marcus Garvey. She took college credits at Lemoyne. So now she's considered a first semester junior. And so she'll be graduating from the University of Arkansas in Pambla in a 2-year time period instead of normal 4 years. But her foundation for both of my children, both of my two girls, are Marcus Garvey Institute, because they teach at an accelerated pace. In fact, my child who's at Hollis Price now is an 11th grader. When she was in the 8th grade, she was working with St. Jude on some reading materials, some reading issues, because she has a health concern. And they noticed that she was reading on a college level in 8th grade. Well, that foundation was built in Marcus Garvey. Because they don't limit you by your age or your grade. They limit you by your ability to master the material. They still do that.
We have a very limited amount of time, but I wonder if you could. I know that there are bound to be many listeners that are not familiar with who Marcus Garvey is. Could you give a little biography on him quickly? I know that's a hard thing to ask to do.
Marcus Garvey was a person who came from Jamaica. He was a black nationalist. He was asking black folks to come together, let's do something for ourselves. In fact, they had a Back to Africa movement, trying to get black folks who were suffering in this country, let's get a steamship line, let's take our people back to Africa, where we came from, and we could build cities there instead of trying to suffer over here under the yoke of oppression that we were going through over here. He also was teaching black people to love yourself, respect yourself, and do something for yourself, because you are the greatest. And we need to stop. We need to stop all this bickering from one religion to another. So he was not trying to steer people into a religion, but trying to steer them into a way of thinking about themselves and their future. He was arrested on some trumped up charges. He was released from prison after the fraudulent charges were examined. He was released from prison, but he was forced to leave the country. They wouldn't let him stay here because they did not want him to galvanize the people with over 2 million followers at the time. Marcus Garvey was galvanizing black people from all religious persuasion.
What was the time frame of that, Omar?
Late 1920s, early 1930s.
1920s and 30s. And I bet that's a little bit of history there that a lot of folks have never heard of.
And we need to read Marcus Garvey and study him dearly.
Yeah, and he has written some books. Or where would you find information on him besides Google and Wikipedia?
They're sold at Amazon, and you can buy them off the internet at Amazon. You can also find them in the public library.
Okay, on the life of Marcus Garvey is very interesting. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. We've only got a few seconds left.
I want to
thank you for giving us a little perspective on your prison ministry on Kwanzaa and all the way to Marcus Garvey. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Brother Renfrew. Thank you so much.
Thank
everybody listening in.
Thank you very again. I want to invite listeners to go to www.iam-cor.org and view the virtual campus of the Institute of Applied Metaphysics. There are free e-books you can download, and you can also peruse the 3-degree levels of study that are offered. And, of course, go to Blog Talk Radio go to the archives and listen to some of these shows. You may listen to this one again. Go to YouTube, type in Renfrew Broadcast Network, and you can see when Omar Baruti appeared on Core Concepts not so long ago. It's been a couple of years, but not so long ago. And thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight on the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. Have a good evening, everyone.
Thank you.